Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We're the number one global fintech podcast and radio show in 180 countries with over 6.5 million listeners. Glad you could join us. This week, we traveled to Shanghai, where we attended the Huawei FSI Global Summit, that's financial services industry. We had the opportunity to sit down with a bunch of leaders from around the world on banking, but we sat with Jason Chow, who is the FSI lead for Huawei, for their enterprise business group, and also to Yuzhao Hu, who's their main AI guy there, where we talked about technologies like artificial intelligence, what Huawei is doing in edge computing in terms of the sort of next generation distributed cloud architecture, and 5G tech and a bunch of other things. We spoke about how bankers in the future are going to have to respond to all these technology changes. I'm sure you're going to enjoy the episode. But before we get to that, let me tell you about our sponsor this week. LinkedIn is our sponsor for our show this week. And as you know, hiring isn't as easy as putting an ad in the paper or posting on a job board these days. With more qualified candidates than ever, you need something that helps you find the right people for your business, and LinkedIn Jobs does just that. Now, if you guys know any of your stats about LinkedIn, two professionals join LinkedIn every second. That's over 600 million users on the LinkedIn platform today. In America alone, there's 154 million American workers that are on the LinkedIn platform, and 50% of Americans on the platform have a college degree, and they use LinkedIn. We see a lot of upper management support. 57% of LinkedIn users on mobile. 3 million American jobs alone are posted on LinkedIn every month. And 2 million posts, articles, and videos are published on LinkedIn every day. Now, we use LinkedIn job tracking and job support for Movin. We do all of our non-executive hires through LinkedIn, and it's been a fantastic tool for Movin in terms of creating opportunity. So I'd encourage you guys to check it out. 90% of LinkedIn users are open to new opportunities. They're not actively scanning job boards. That means LinkedIn gives you sort of unique access to these people. So it gets your job in front of the most relevant, qualified candidates so you can focus on making the hire you're excited about. Post a job today at linkedin.com/fintech and you'll get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/fintech. Terms and conditions apply. All right, now the news this week, you would have heard maybe that ANZ has converted 9,000 IT staff to agile development. We hear a lot about agile right now, but a lot of the banks are really focusing on agile development to support the ongoing needs of the bank. And this is really key. Now, IBM and Thomson Reuters have teamed up on AI and data-driven compliance offerings, so be interesting to see how that rolls out. We also see Morgan Stanley starting up a multicultural innovation lab. But the news that I thought was very interesting is a blockchain implementation out of Canada. It's a bank-backed blockchain-based ID verification system. Now, if you guys have listened to Dave Birch on the show previously, you'll know that one of the great use cases potentially for blockchain is consensus-based shareable ID information with trusted partners. So CIBC, Desjardins, RBC, Scotiabank, and TD have already partnered with this Toronto-based SecureKey and the Verified.me app, helping users verify their identity simply online. So it's sort of like a KYC sharing system there, way ahead of the chaos that we have here in the United States, and indeed in most countries. Anyway, that's some of the news today. But let's now go to our first interview. This is our interview with Huawei. We're speaking to Jason Chao, who is the head of the financial services industry team at the Enterprise Business Group for Huawei, talking about how financial services has been impacted in China by the rise of the tech giants like Alipay, Ant Financial, and Tencent WeChat. And also we speak to Hu Xiao, who is the expert on AI implementation for Huawei in terms of its implementation in financial services. So I'm here in Shanghai with the team from Huawei, where we're here for the Global FSI Summit. This is the Financial Services Industry Global Summit. I have the head of the Financial Services Industry Practice for Huawei, Jason Chao. Welcome, Jason.
Hello.
And also the top AI advisor for Huawei in the space is Hu Xiao. Hu?
Hi, Brett. I really enjoy reading your book.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I wanted to get into some of the technologies you are working with. Now, obviously, people know you in respect to the 5G technology and your telecommunications technologies, but increasingly, you're making a ton of investment in areas like artificial intelligence and edge computing. So if we take those three technologies, Yuzia, maybe you can give us some perspective. Help us understand, those three key technologies and how they relate to each other in terms of where these technologies are going.
Huawei's perspective is that everything will be connected, everything will be sensing, and everything will be intelligent. So 5G is connecting everything. So millions or billions of devices will be connected. And AI is used to power these different devices. We believe that the future is that the cloud and the edge fused by AI. So basically, the data will be flowed from edge to the cloud, and then there AI is used to process all this data and create the intelligence. So that's we see the interactions between the AI and edge and also cloud.
So AI is like the glue that puts these together, right?
Yeah.
Now, in terms of AI, when we're talking about Huawei, we're talking about two types of developments. You're not only working on algorithms, but you guys are also developing specialized chipsets for artificial intelligence. So where would those chips be used, for example?
Oh, it will be used everywhere or nowhere. You will never notice where it is. So when we talk about AI, we talk about ABC of AI. So basically, we talk about algorithms, we talk about big data, we also talk about computing powers. So chips is the fundamental things to power all these things together. Mm-hmm. So you will see our chips will be, currently we have SN310 and also 19, which can be used in different variety of different devices, including your mobile phone, including some edge devices, and also servers. And going forward, we will have all these different series of chips which can be used on every devices and to give them the AI power. So basically, after several years, you will see them everywhere or you will totally forget where they are because you will use them and you don't need to worry about where are they.
Like electricity.
Yeah, exactly.
Electricity there.
That's why we call it AI is another general purpose technology.
Yes. Now, China, of course, is leading the world in artificial intelligence investment right now. Over the last 5-6 years, more than half of the global investment in artificial intelligence has come out of China. So could you give me some examples of where AI is already being implemented in China, where it's already being used?
Jason, maybe you
want to jump in?
Okay, that'd be good. I think we have AI here.
In the smartphone.
Yeah, in a smartphone already. No, it's a so small device, we already put a lot of AI innovation inside. Yeah, when you make pictures. Yeah.
Right, so yeah. Image processing.
Yes.
Yeah, and image recognition.
Yes, a lot of things. Even my son using that. We have a special function. If you see something you don't know what's that, you use this phone camera. Yeah.
And it will identify it.
Yeah, it will tell you what's that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, exactly.
Which phone is this in?
This is our phone we launched last year, May 20.
The P20.
Yeah, yeah. May 20.
Oh, May 20.
Yeah, May 20 Pro. Yeah.
May 20 Pro.
Pro, yes.
You know. That's pretty cool. Yeah. And you also have voice-based AI, of course, in as sort of standard with the Huawei handsets now, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so China, how is China adopting to things like facial recognition and voice recognition in the public? How do you think the average Chinese person that walks into a KFC and uses facial recognition or something like that, how do they perceive this technology?
I think it's quite a lot. How many exactly, I don't know. But at least all of my colleagues, you know, and they, for sure, we have the mobile payments.
Yes.
They don't need a wallet anymore. But when you really sometimes need cash, they go to the cash machine by the face.
They use the face to withdraw from the ATM.
Yeah, withdraw from the ATM.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds like science fiction if you live in the U.S., this sort of thing.
Yes.
I saw recently an article about JetBlue using facial recognition for checking in for flights and someone getting very upset because they realized that the Department of Homeland Security had their facial scan and that was enabling them to get on the flight and they were unaware of it. So I think this is a bit of a cultural difference between China and the US, which means China consumers appear more accepting of these technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And so these innovations, at least a consumer or market level, appear to be able to be implemented in society faster. That's an interesting observation.
Yeah.
Jason, when we talk specifically about things like edge computing and AI, how do they have a role to play in the future of banking? You know, you've announced a couple of technologies related to edge and improvements in the cloud. How do you see banks using these Huawei technologies in the future?
Okay. So we do believe we are a technology company. We have to look what will happen next 10 years, 20 years, yeah. As Yuxiao mentioned, we do believe in the future it will be, we call it, everything will be sensor, everything will be connected, and everything will be intelligent, you know. If we're talking about that, you know, AI, you know, it's, I think, the basic thing. Yeah, for everything, you need to be intelligent. But the first step right now, we think there are a lot of things that they are not connected. You know, then we think for all of this edge layer, if you want it to be more intelligent, you know, we need a very strong edge capability.
Right.
Yeah. Which for the banks the same. You know, right now, I think the bank today serve the customers, I think, is still more or less a traditional way, but it's fastly evolving. Let's imagine in the future, there will be a lot of services, you know. The banks is not just a bank, they provide all different services. You know, there will be a lot of services which today we even couldn't imagine will be there. You know, these services is embedded in people's daily life, everywhere. Then, in this layer, you need a very strong, intelligent, with a strong computing power to
low
enable
latency.
Yeah, low latency.
Yeah.
Yeah. And high bandwidth. Yeah, services. In this case, we think AI, edge computing, then plus 5G.
Yes.
Will change the world.
Makes sense.
Will change our life totally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Yuxiao, I know you're the AI expert, but for banks who are still struggling to get onto cloud right now, how would you describe the difference between the cloud as it appears today and edge computing?
Okay, so for edge computing, that means that the difference between edge computing and the cloud computing, basically we don't choose them from A or B. So basically it's not a different answer. Basically, I believe that we should combine them together. The devices, like a mobile phone, the edge computing, and the like a smart box and the cloud, they should all be combined together. Just depend on what kind of information we used, what kind of intelligence we used. Either it can be processed directly on-site on my mobile phone, for example, fingerprint recognition. I want to keep the highest security, so it can only happen on my mobile phone. I don't want to upload it to anywhere. Or it can happen on edge devices. For example, we detect some faces, and we just recognize the face on the edge devices, and we transport the face ID instead of the face images to the cloud, right, to save our bandwidth, to keep the privacy, and to make things smooth. And of course, there are also a lot of computations need to be happened on the cloud. The cloud can process all this information collected from the whole city and make the best decision to manage the traffic and to manage different businesses. So that's why I believe that for AI will happen everywhere on the devices, on the edges, and also on cloud. And all of this will bring us an intelligent world.
So you mentioned traffic. So if we talk about literal traffic and autonomous vehicles, for example, mm-hmm. you might have the 3D maps that we'll use for autonomous vehicles to navigate with GPS and so forth in the cloud. But when you have vehicles that are on the road updating those maps with critical information, that may be more immediately accessible through edge computing devices connected to that network.
Yes, exactly.
Is that a good illustration?
Yeah, exactly. So basically, instead of transfer data and do the computations, we also need to bring the computation power to the data to make things smoother.
Yes.
And besides that, I also want to mention that this is also one important application for 5G. So Huawei has drive a lot on this, making this 5G happen with low latency, with a big bandwidth, and also can connect millions of devices together. So this is also useful for autonomous driving cars, because the cars cannot only rely on the maps. The cars need to talk to cars need to talk to pedestrians, cars need to talk to the roads. So the car itself needed to know all this information from the connections and make the best decision. So that's 5G is also very important.
Now, Jason, we didn't talk about this question before, but I'm sure you can answer it. But in China, we have a very large adoption of fintech technologies, both through the tech giants, the BATX, but also through other fintechs like Lufax and others that are operating here in China. So because the fact that you've got a large part of the population using fintech every day, like payments technologies and so forth, how has the introduction of these fintech players into the market put pressure on banks, do you think?
Oh, I think that's probably you won't see it anywhere else. Yeah, in China, it's kind of a revolutionary thing,
right,
for the whole society.
Yes.
Yeah. In last, I think, 15 years, this kind of internet force really changed the society and changed the people's behavior in China. Even you talk about today, the beggars in the street use the QR code.
Right.
This is already not new. They already have a lot of new business model. It's almost everywhere. And
if you have a phone, you can accept a merchant payment, right?
You can do everything. And this kind of impact is now not only for the consumers, it is also to the business customers. That's why, I mean, in the last years, in last decades, all the banks, the leading banks in China, they already, I think, reacted.
Yeah.
They think
they've had to, yeah?
Yeah, they have to. That's why. Because of these challenges. And I think they are, if you talk about the business or the technology, I think they are in a leading position compared to the other countries.
Yes.
Yeah. For example, we are working with some of them. They already a huge bank like ICBC, a China Merchant Bank. They already done this transformation years ago.
Yes.
Try to adopt themselves. Yeah. To behave the same, or even they want to be better compared to the internet companies.
Yes.
Right now you mentioned this morning, and the behavior information, behavior yes. data is really, really important. I think all of them now recognize this problem. Yes. For example, I think like China Merchants Bank, they are now, they don't put the profit or revenue as a main target. They put MAU.
Yeah.
You know, this is how they treat themselves like the internet.
So companies. This is the monthly active users.
Yeah.
This is what Twitter and Facebook and Snapchat and, you know, WeChat all use as their core metric.
Yeah.
So it shifts to being where banks used to talk about acquisition cost of customers and then cross-sell, upsell of products. Now they're talking about engagement. And
exactly.
So it's a very different model, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So let's drill into this a little bit more. You mentioned ICBC. You're working with all the top banks here in China. How are those banks prioritizing their investments in technology right now? So where's the big money going into in technology?
Ah, okay. So I think right now in China, there's no debate. Yeah, if they should be a, how to say, technology company or not, there's no debate.
Right.
All of the banks have such agreement, reach the concern that they have to be
a
technology
yeah.
company. Then they really now invest more and more into the technology. For example, there's a bank said 1% of our revenue we must invest into just the fintech innovation. They take it out of the routine IT investment. They just say, I will spend 1% of my revenue just for innovations without any profit targets.
No concern about ROI.
Yeah.
Just let's see where it
now
goes.
Now they spend more and more percent of money into technology. Yeah. This is, I think, a quite good sign. Secondly, I want to say, where are the priorities? I think in the last years, the main priority, I think, was to go for cloud. Yeah, from the legacy traditional architecture, go for cloud. I think right now, a lot of them have done that. The main thing now for them is about the data. How to manage user data, because the banks have more and more data. Yeah, for sure, compared to the internet companies, the data not so much, but anyhow, they still got more and more how to use it. Yeah, better serve the customers. This is the main thing.
Mm.
Yeah, and another thing is definitely it's about AI. Yeah, all the banks think AI will change them and change the people, the user experience. That's why now this is the main priorities for them.
So Yuxiao, when we talk about AI investment in the banks, here in China and globally today, what's the current focus on AI investments in financial institutions?
For this, I think I first just took your methodology about the first principles.
Yes.
So we think about what people really want, right, in the fintech, so in the finance institutions. So the first thing is that people want to save money, save values too. And for this, definitely, there are different products from the banks. So it's better for the banks to understand the user, provide the better experiences. Just like you don't need to go to a branch, you don't need to go to a bank branch, and currently you can do mobile, but also you can do it with voice assistant. And for AI, you can easily ask your voice assistant, recognize your voice, and also recognize what you want to do and save money or extract money from the bank. So this is one thing easily we can do. Also, of course, nowadays in the States, people can take a picture of their checks and can deposit it. It's currently it's very common, and I use it a lot. I can save a trip to the bank branch. And this is the one.
Some consumers in the U.S. will do that to transfer money between their own bank accounts because the electronic transfer system, ACH, is so slow in the U.S.
Yeah.
So we're not used to that in China here because, you know, you've got things like Alipay and WeChat Pay, where you can basically transfer money as often as you want, instantly to anyone in China.
Yeah, the second part is like a move money between me and my friends, or between this account of my another account of mine. So this thing is like AI also trying to reduce the process time or make this whole process automatically. So there are a lot of like RPA happened. It's called
robotic process automation.
Automation is to improve the efficiency. Of course, if I want to move something from this place to another place, the only thing I care about is the result and is the speed. I don't care what's going on there. There's 1,000 steps. I just want to see my money there in the target. So this is one thing. And the third thing is you said that it's credit. I want to access my credit. So currently AI has made a big progress on this, try to understand the behaviors of the user and to do the user profiling and also try to understand this and help the banks to make the best decision to make the like fraud control and other things. And we start from some rule-based method, and currently we can even learn from the big data, and then that we can make the decision very fast. When you slide your credit card, when you apply to the a credit card, or you apply something to the mortgage loan to the bank, they can make decisions much, much faster than before.
Very good. So one final question for you both. If you were a bank CEO today, what would you be doing as a result of these emerging technologies? How would you be acting? Where would you be investing? Who would you be hiring?
Actually, this question is my question for you.
Okay.
You are stand on both sides.
Yes.
Yeah? One side, you are looking at the banking industry, what happened. Yeah. On the other side, you are running a bank.
Right.
You know, for sure, I think basically what I see right now, I'm a fan of you.
Thank you.
I bring this with me when I trip. Yeah, I have a trip.
The Bank 4.0.
Yeah, 4.0. Yeah. I look forward, you know, I don't know when the Bank 5.0 will be there.
I talked about that sometimes, but 5.0 is essentially when we don't have banks. Uh-huh. Or money the way we do today. So I don't know, maybe 100 years from now. I don't think I will write that book.
But at least I think, we are working with a lot of leading banks in China or outside China. I have found that the banks who are now really doing well, these banks really think they should change. Yeah, I really like what you mentioned. Yeah. The capability of change.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think to be more open, change fast.
Yes.
I think this is the main thing. So for Huawei, we as a technology provider, we think our target is to provide the future-proof technology.
Right.
Yeah. We have to, stand today, but we have to look what will happen tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. That's why you see all our design, our product, our ideas, is thinking what will happen in the future. I try to give the customer the future.
And Huawei's culture in terms of investment and R&D in the future is very strong, isn't it? I mean, what percentage of your profits go back into R&D and into development of these technologies? A considerable portion, right?
Yesterday, the Spirit Bank, they mentioned about the ROE of the bank.
The ROE.
Yeah, 8 or 9% is not so good. Yeah,
yeah.
Actually, as a technology company, we think that is good because we have to keep a lot of investment into future.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, as far as I know, we invest at least more than 10%.
We invest 15%.
Yeah, last year
15%.
15% we invested. And I also try to answer your question about the CEO position. So first of all, I really want to be in that position of a bank CEO. Yeah.
Really? I don't know if I'd like to be. Well, I am a bank CEO. For a big bank, I'm not sure.
Yeah. The reason behind this is that I'm still, from my point of view, AI, a developer or researcher. So when I was doing AI things, I really hope that I know more about the domain knowledges.
Yes.
So I think that all the algorithms or the computations or the powers or the data, these things can be solved by technical stuff.
Mm.
But it's very difficult for our engineer and for our researchers to know about, to have the domain knowledges. So that's why I really hope I'm a CEO of a bank so that I can have a better understanding about what's going on here in the banking and what's the pain point, what's the real requirement of the bank. So if I was a position in the bank of CEO, I would definitely think about what's going on here and what's my pain point, and then I would drag somebody from AI said can help me to solve it.
So, Britt, thank you very much for your participation in this Huawei FSI.
It's great to be back with you guys. Last year, of course, we were in Beijing.
Yeah.
But it's nice to be back in Shanghai.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
And you're back with Breaking Banks. I'm Brett King, your host. Now, in the next interview, we caught up with our good friend Matthias Kroner. Matthias, if you guys recall, was the founder and a CEO of really one of the first fintechs in the world, first neobanks, rather, in the world, which is Fidor Bank, founded in Germany in 2007. So he tells the foundation story, tells us a bit about the growth and his recent exit from the business in this interview we recorded in Manila. After Matthias's interview, we'll speak with the Fintech Association of the Philippines and see what's happening there, and also to Avi from Union Bank X, UBX, and their fintech startup attached to Union Bank of the Philippines. Let's first of all go to Matthias from Fidor Bank.
So I stopped in at Manila this week after a visit to Shanghai last week, and I ran into my good friend and pal, who we've been working together for, well, not technically working together, but have been in the fintech trenches for many years, Matthias Kroner, previously, of course, the CEO and founder of Fidor. Good to catch up with you, dude.
Hi, Brad. I'm so happy to meet you. Thank you.
Now, obviously, you've had some big changes. You had a successful exit from your business. It was acquired by a French bank. You yourself have seen that through. Let's just get a little bit of history behind Fidor. When was it founded? The growth years, and give us a bit more detail before the acquisition about Fidor's growth and history.
Yeah, wonderful. Happy to do so. So Fidor was actually founded back in 2007. We started the idea, to be
one
precise.
One of the first challenger banks.
Definitely. And the phrase fintech was not around. Remember, that was, Germany's, for instance, still was recovering from the internet bubble. And in 2007, my partners and I, we thought about, we had a look to the development and the market, like e-commerce, Web 2.0, social media, and so on and so forth. And we realized that consumer behavior is changing. And our thesis those days was that this changing consumer behavior will not stop at the retailers. It will affect the banking relation of such a consumer as well, which gave us enough motivation to actually apply for banking license. Financial crisis was something that happened straight after we applied for the license. However, we received it in 2009 and opened our...
This was from the German regulator?
The German regulators, BaFin and Bundesbank, exactly. And we opened our digital doors then in 2010. the core DNA those days of Fedora was that we had in the center of our thinking, acting, and technology a community, which enabled the registered users to exchange about money topics and so on, compare products and stuff like that, and come to a totally new level of interaction, integration, and usage of such a banking platform.
Now, in those early days, as you say, fintech wasn't sort of a term that we would use. But how did you consider yourself different from a traditional bank, apart from just being digital?
Yeah, very good question. Makes me think for a second. So first of all, I would say having a clear look to this customer centricity is something still I must admit is different to the majority of banks, first of all. Believing in the fact that, and this is second, is that technology can provide you a unique selling proposition, I think is something that made Fedora totally different to anybody else. Believing in the fact that openness actually supporting to the growth of Fedora, which allowed us to integrate, for instance, the first crowdfunding partners, the first peer-to-peer partners.
Plus, and you used social media as a core piece.
Totally. And by that, and that would be the fourth part then of it, having the social media aspect of it and having received also the feedback and the feeling from the customers and users that via those technical channels, actually, you're way closer than any branch banker or head of branch bank who never talks to his customers, actually. You're very close and you had supporters suddenly instead of customers. So I think, and many more components, but these just the first ones that pop up in my mind, actually, once you ask me that, I think this made us dramatically different.
Now, you recently went through an acquisition process. Tell me, what's it like as a founder to go through that process where, you know, you're engaging with someone and you're selling the business that you've built over all those years, over a decade, right?
Yeah, well, actually, it's so first of all, I have to say I'm living in the web world, so to say, which showed me, proved me, taught me that actually this kind of built to last or built to keep thing is not existing. Which means whenever you start something, you already started in a sense that one, there will be the day when you will exit that. I think this is something which is extremely clear, was extremely clear to me, still is clear to me. And I experienced that twice now. I had the privilege to co-found actually DAB Bank. The German listeners will remember that maybe.
That IPO'd.
And IPO'd in 99. We founded that in 94. We IPO'd in 99. We ran full sales. We ran into the internet bubble actually in 2000. We acquired a French company in 2000. And I left it at the end of 2002. And now with Fedora, we had, let me say, about the same process, like setting it up in 2010, having a number of capital increases in between, doing a full capital replacement by 2016, and now having my total exit end of March 2019. So,
what's a capital replacement?
A capital replacement actually is when you have the opportunity to buy all the existing shares from the existing shareholders, which means that, for instance, the private equity or venture cap friends who invested in us, all of them had been willing to sell off on the one side. And on the other side, it is that the acquiring party is buying all those shares. So it's a tremendous different approach to a capital increase, which remains the existing shareholders, but will add on a new shareholder as via a capital increase. So that's a capital replacement.
Now, one of the challenges that we see with fintechs and acquiring banks and banks that invest in fintechs as well, or, you know, acquire, you know, we've seen recently TD acquire an AI company. We see Cap One acquire Adaptive Path, the design agency. What do you see as challenges in terms of culture when you have a fairly traditional bank try to acquire a fintech that has been very agile, very much focused on technologies, and you know, their people skills and their organization structure are very, very different.
Yeah, that after doing this for 25 years now, being for 25 years in innovation-centric companies, more or less 25 years of having incumbent shareholders, and seeing all those examples that you mentioned, and we can add an endless list to this of an incumbent company acquiring an innovation-centric company, no matter whether it's banking or not, I would say each of those industries has its specifics, in particular within banking, as we have risk management, we have this compliance topics and so on and so forth. But I would say this is applying for the other industries as well. So, yeah, the crucial question really is, can it work? And right. if it comes to that question and you answer that with yes, actually, the next question would be, and how can it work? But let us start maybe at the analysis of it, and let us look at the dimensions we have to talk about, actually. So, and maybe just to raise some of them, not a complete list, but I would say the first of all, the leadership team of an incumbent versus an innovation-centric company, the leadership team is totally acting differently. Normally, I would say that the leadership team in an incumbent is more like the management style versus the startup is an entrepreneurial style. With that comes actually that once you talk about risk management, the incumbent is totally risk-averse, I would say. And I'm speaking in general terms, so of course there will be exemptions. However, actually for the startup team, risk is not even the second name, it's the first name. So they're risk-taking at its best and are willing to act on it. Skin in the game might be another dimension. A manager of a company has, let me be frank, no skin in the game. The only thing a manager in a company can lose is maybe a part of its bonus. That's it. Versus the startup entrepreneurs actually having all the money of the family, maybe lend money from the parents to set it up and skin in the game, definitely.
And friends. Yeah.
And friends and everything. And this person, you know, wants to meet its family, his or her family again and the friends, and not being questioned like, where's my money and why did you sink it and so on, you know. I think that all comes once we look to the life cycle of those companies. An incumbent company might be at the peak of a life cycle or beyond it, and maybe even facing strong strategic questions whether it will be dead in the future or it needs to reinvent itself. The startup company is, of course, in the beginning, as the name says, in the beginning of its life cycle and needs to have a different skill set for its leadership team. So, out of this life cycle perspective, and let us compare that maybe stupidly to a baseball game, actually. You start with a different type of pitcher, your baseball game that you ended. It can be fairly questioned, I would say, that will the management teams or the leadership teams of those two companies ever understand them? Because I would say they speak totally different languages. They speak about totally different topics. They have different objectives. The objective maybe of, for instance, let us talk about the shareholder, a very important group. The shareholder of an incumbent is expecting dividends. The shareholder of a fintech or a startup is expecting X time the investment.
X multiples.
Yeah. So can that ever match? I have to ask that. Currently, I'm a bit biased, maybe, but currently I would say I really question that, right?
So now you've handed the reins over to a new team. You've recently retired from Fedor. Yeah, left Fedor, this baby you created, but it's the second time you've done this. Yeah. So what's next for MK?
Yeah, well, it's you know, sitting here with you in Manila, actually, and having had the chance to speak openly over the last days, and having seen at the event we met today, actually, all these many ideas that are on the table, I would say it's such an exciting time. I find it to be exciting because the options and the possibilities that are emerging with, for instance, an advancing technological development are phenomenal. We, on the one side, on the other side, we have markets like talking about the Philippines, you know, 150 million people. We heard today that 30% are unbanked, 30% are banked, 70% are unbanked. Yeah. We did speak about the SME banking in Asia, and so on and so forth. It's tremendous. Last year, I had the chance to attend a G20 summit in Riyadh organized by the IFC, actually, about how fintech can support financial inclusion. You know, this is all coming into play now. There are so much things to do, and I think there's so much valuable things to do, and you can do this in these days, actually, in a very value-centric approach. It's definitely not the problem to find equity or capital for this. It's definitely okay. The biggest challenge, what is a proper value proposition? No doubt about it. Have a proper concept, that's for sure. I would say the biggest challenge is find the right people for your team. There I have to admit that personally, this is also my biggest learning curve over all the years. Equity, I would say, is not the problem. Technological feasibility, I would say, is not the problem. Opportunities are overwhelming.
So one last question, and I get asked this all the time, and I'm sure you do as well. If you were the CEO of a major bank today, what would you do? What would be the major thing? How would you start this process?
The transformation, like, would I go for transformation or for acquisition?
What you know, if you were the CEO of a bank, where would you start?
So I would really try to find out whether how much my team, how much my shareholders are willing to go into this kind of digital journey. Would I ask my customers about it? Maybe not, because those are the ones, and you raised the example today as well. Like if Henry Ford would have asked the guys those days before coming back with the car,
wanted a faster horse.
They wanted a faster horse. Exactly. This is what you would get as an answer. So I would say the team, the management, and the shareholders need to be aligned on this. And then it's a, of course, technical question. Get rid of your incumbent technology. Brutally, the question will be, can you afford it? The next question is really align the team radically, seriously, radically. Get rid of the people that will show up in the moment you have a failure, and you will have a failure. Get rid of those people who will show up and say, I could have told you 2 years ago what you think is bullshit. So this is really, you need to be as homogeneous as possible on that.
No half measures. Okay, great. Well, Matthias Kroner, thank you for joining us on Breaking Banks, and always a pleasure to spend some time together, my friend.
Always a pleasure to meet you. Great. Thank you so much.
So while I was also in Manila, I caught up with the team at Union Bank of the Philippines, and they have created their own sort of fintech startup ecosystem called UBX. It sits to the side of the traditional organization, but has some elements of convergence, but it has a much broader mandate than just providing technology or fintech-like capabilities for Union Bank. So with us is the executive director of UBX, Avi De Vera. And Avi was also one of the key guys behind organizing the event that we had in Manila with Nendu Manhanti from MAS, Matthias Kroner from Exfidor, Jay Reinemann from Propel VC, and others that came together to talk the ongoing disruption of fintech in countries like Manila. So, Avi, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thanks for having me, Brett.
Tell me a bit more about UBX.
So UBX was born out of the bank itself, Union Bank, really wanting to work closely and collaborate with fintechs. We have a fintech business group in the bank, which I also head. So we started this journey about 3 years ago, where we said we want to be the fintech bank of choice. When the discussion then was collaborate or disrupt or friend or foe with fintechs, we said, no, we want to work with them. So how do we do that? So at the bank, we first bank them as customers, then we enable them, then we experiment and synergize with them. But if there's a strategic fit, we want to invest in them. And to do that, we realized we couldn't do it in the bank. So we created UBX to be the natural vehicle to do that.
So you created both an investment arm, sort of a mini VC, and a sort of an incubator?
Yes, but it's not a traditional VC or a VC as we know it, because the main objective is not to consider exits, but to consider strategic value to the bank. So anything we invest in is because the bank or the group can actually leverage off that platform or that fintech.
So you are looking at strategic investments where it can add value to your stack, right?
That's correct. And at the same time, give us access to new platforms or ecosystems where a bank may or may not be the primary activity. So, a healthcare ecosystem or an educational school ecosystem where the bank may play a role somewhere down the road, but not necessarily upfront.
Now, how did you come to being involved in this personally? Because you've been with the bank for a while.
Yes, I've been at the bank for 9 years, and my role progressed from, I started really as corporate product, and from there, the bank, Union Bank has traditionally been a very innovative bank. Before there was fintech, we were already creating solutions for very large corporates, and we would customize and innovate for large corporates. So when fintech became mainstream, we were more than happy to collaborate and work with them, because that would mean we would not have to build the tech ourselves. So it really helped us scale faster in our traditional business, but at the same time, we saw an opportunity for more, which is why we evolved into fintech after that. So it was a natural progression. It wasn't something we just did overnight.
Now, from a leadership perspective, how important has this been to get, have strong support from the leadership of Union Bank? And who really has been the sponsor internally, to UBX and kicking it off?
Oh, that's tremendous. I mean, the support we get from the chairman, Tito Ortiz, who is the main driver of this, and our president and CEO, Edwin Bautista. They are, both my toughest supporters and also my toughest critics. So with them, we actually drive this strategy together. So it's very important. And it, even with their support, it's difficult to get an incumbent traditional bank to pivot. But it's possible only because of their support. So you need senior leadership support to sell it to the board and to push it at management level.
Okay. Now tell me about the team that you've got working within UBX.
Oh, that's fantastic, Brett. That's a great question. And it actually resonates well with your book, because when I'm not a traditional banker, I started my career in Citibank, but got bored and decided to try.
Didn't everyone start at Citibank? I'm just checking. It feels like that sometimes.
It does. And most of us at Union did. But I left early on and wanted to explore the world outside of banking. And I went to telco and media and full circle back to banking. So I'm not a traditional banker. But when I started building my team, I did exactly that. I looked for non-bankers. I did not want bankers, because I felt that we couldn't solve the existing problems.
You have been listening.
I have been. So I don't know if you wrote your book because of my influence or the other way around. But definitely, we're a team of about 40 people, and there are only 3 bankers on my fintech team. And on UBX, we're totally non-bankers there. I mean, the CEO, John Januzak, is from insurance, but not banking at all. So we've made that conscious decision not to get bankers. So we're hiring based on mindset and based on attitude rather than skill set, which is a given, of course, that you have competencies in business development and product, but definitely not banking.
So tell me about some of the portfolio companies that you're supporting through UBX, and what do they bring to the table?
Well, we're looking at, again, we're talking about leveraging value for the main bank, and that is lending. If you talk about the main bank, the strength of the bank is the balance sheet. So we're looking at primarily companies or ecosystems that can contribute to that. So you have payment companies and lending companies. Payment companies insofar as they can create data for which the bank can lend to. Lending companies, but not traditional. We're talking about alternative finance companies, those doing lending based on telco behavior, social media score. Those are the kind of things we want to look for, because the goal is to leverage the bank's balance sheet to do lending. And of course, blockchain as well, which is a very important technology we want to leverage on.
So where do you see UBX going over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, that's a journey. We've gotten approval from the central bank to do something very new to the Philippine banking industry, which is create this fintech investment company under UBX. The board has given us the mandate. And, we have a roadmap, but we also want to make sure that we execute according to the board's expectations year on year. So we only see our pipeline growing and us participating in other technologies as well, such as AI, which you called out very much in your book as really the next level for technology. So we need to participate in those ecosystems. So I see us participating in more technologies broader, but at the same time also going ASEAN, because there's so much untapped opportunity in ASEAN. But the Philippines will always be a perfect execution point for fintech. So we have a large unbanked population. There are many gaps in the payment systems, in the lending systems. In insurance penetration is 5%.
So about 70% unbanked, I understand.
That's correct. So all the opportunities here, so a lot of the fintechs, whether they be Indonesian, Singaporean, Hong Kong, even in the US, they come here because this is where the execution is. This is where there are a lot of gaps. So we see ourselves really being that gateway to allow fintechs to execute in the Philippines, and the reverse. Some of the fintechs starting to really gain some traction, we can also bring them to the ASEAN because we participate in the Monetary Authority of Singapore's AFIN, which is their API platform for the ASEAN. So we're looking to really take the Philippines in a way global in terms of fintech, but at the same time localize other fintechs that are coming in.
Avi De Vera, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thanks for having me, Brett, and thanks for coming to the Philippines. Great to have you.
Well, that's it for the show this week, guys. Breaking Banks comes to you from New York City, but we have listeners all around the world. If you could do us a favor, leave us a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you download your podcast from, if you listen to us on podcast. And if you're listening on the AM band in the tri-state area, make sure you tweet us out or get onto social media. You can tweet us at Breaking Banks One on Twitter. That's at Breaking Banks One, or you could go to Facebook, Breaking Banks with Brett King, and give us a shout out. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks again. See you guys next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.